Hello everybody. I would like to start off today's video with a kind of metaphor. So, growing up, I was quite a big fan of World War II, you know, just learning about it. I was a little bit of a World War II buff, I guess you could say. And of course, one of the most famous battles during the Second World War was Operation Barbarossa, where Germany invaded the Soviet Union and made it all the way as far as Moscow and Stalingrad before they were eventually pushed back by the Russians. Now, in 1941, right before the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, the Wehrmacht, the German army, they were considered to be on the cutting edge for that time. Like, the whole concept of Blitzkrieg had been invented by the Germans, and they had the Luftwaffe, and they had total morale and discipline, and they had those nice shiny uniforms, and, you know, they had everything going for them in 1941. The Russians, on the other hand, well, the Red Army had been completely decimated in the 1930s with Stalin's purges. Morale was at an all-time low. Their tank technology was decades behind. Their air force was non-existent. They had ancient biplanes. During the purges of the late 1930s, Stalin had effectively executed 70% of the Red Army's leadership. So they were completely demoralized. They were just in no position whatsoever to go up against the Wehrmacht. And yeah, in the early days of the battle, they got completely decimated. Like, they lost so much land in the first couple of months of the summer offensive of 1941. They just completely got wiped out. I think they lost like 1 million troops in the first few months of the war. Now, the way that Stalin reacted to the news that Germany had invaded Russia is somewhat legendary. It's said that he retreated to his room for several days where he drank heavily, refusing to believe that the Führer had betrayed him. But what is known, what is a fact of history, is that once Stalin came to terms with it, like once he had accepted the fact that the Germans were invading his country, his very first order was to counterattack back towards Germany. Now, the Russians were losing hundreds of kilometers of territory, like nearly every day. Like, the Germans were just basically driving at full speed across the Russian plains towards Moscow. And the more the Russians just charged back at the Germans that were invading, it just made it easier for the Germans to surround them. Now, if Stalin had just ordered a fighting retreat back to the Stalin line near Moscow, it's unlikely that the Germans would have ever made it as far as the Volga River. They would have been immediately pushed back as soon as they came to the Stalin line, because their troops would have been fresh. There would have been about 1 million more of them. And by that stage, the Germans would have been hyperextended. However, Stalin, in all of his hubris, nearly cost Russia the Second World War by making the decision to immediately counter the German invasion. It was only the winter weather that really saved them. Now, eventually, of course, the Red Army would go on to find victory on the Eastern Front, but it wasn't until the Germans began to invade the Caucasus region along the River Don that the Russians finally figured out how to counteract the Wehrmacht. What they did is they started to retreat across the Caucasus region towards the city of Stalingrad, and they set as many booby traps along the way as possible. In fact, one of the things that the Red Army is quite infamous for is they, when they would leave a town, when they would abandon a town to the Germans to occupy, they would set booby traps in the houses so the Germans would show up. And they would be like, you know, why did the Ruskies leave the mayor's residence fully intact, fully furnished for us to occupy and, you know, set up our headquarters at? And then a week later, a bomb would go off and, you know, detonate. And this happened, you know, all across the Eastern Front. And it's not clear how deliberate it was, but what they essentially did in Stalingrad is the Red Army basically lured the Germans into a trap. You know, they made them feel more comfortable than they ought to be. They had weak Romanian soldiers on the fringes of the front line, and the Red Army organized a counterattack that ended up costing the lives of hundreds of thousands of German soldiers and turn the tide of the war. All right, so I've been talking for, what, 5 minutes now about the Second World War? And you're probably wondering, like, well, that's a great synopsis of Operation Barbarossa there, bro, but what does that have to do with the title of the video? So the way I look at it, there is a metaphor buried in this story, okay? There's a hidden fable here. The Russian army, the Soviets, they found their strength that was there all along because, like I said, the Russians were always kind of destined to win the war. Not literally, I don't mean like literally destiny. I just mean that they had the raw materials, they had the bigger country, they had such a big canvas to defeat Germany. But you see, it wasn't until they started to fall back, it wasn't until they started to retreat, that they started to gain the upper hand in the conflict. Now, not literally, I'm not saying that literally retreating is what won them the war. You know, it's a metaphor. It's like, you're not supposed to believe that Gideon defeated the Midianites, you know, with 300 soldiers, all right? It's a metaphor for a deeper truth, is what I'm getting at. The point I'm making is that Stalin's first instinct when the Germans crossed the border was to counterattack, and all it did was dig him into a much deeper hole. The solution was always just to remove himself, or the army, I should say, from the situation and live to fight another day. So that is the metaphor out of the way. That's the metaphorical part of the video done and dusted with. Sorry that took so long, but, you know, I wanted to impress that upon you, okay? But now I'm getting to, like, what this video is actually about, which is dealing with feelings of insecurity. But before I get into that, let's talk about pretty privilege, okay? There is a kind of informal social hierarchy of privilege when it comes to looks, okay? Now, I know that you all know this, but let's just go over it. So, at the top of the kind of, shall we say, social hierarchy of privilege, you have pretty girls, right? And by pretty girls, I mean conventionally attractive women. They don't need to be good-looking in your eyes, okay? They don't need to be perfect tens. They need to just fit a certain kind of archetype. And if they get featured on the right talk show or if they go viral, they can make $1 million in a week, you know? They can become millionaires overnight because, well, they were pretty and they were in the right place at the right time. The next category of pretty privilege is going to be dudes who won the genetic lottery. And not just that, it actually benefited them in some way, all right? I don't need to go over this. You all know who they are. Now, not all of the pretty girls will luck out and become millionaires, okay? Not all of the Chads will become millionaire models. But the people in these top two groups, at the very least, are going to get subtle kind of privilege throughout the course of their lives, and in some case, very acute privilege. But there's one category below these people, okay? And that's everybody else, okay? Everybody else. And I'm not just talking about sub-fives, but let's be real, okay? Just normie guys in general, all right? They're going to be the people that are getting mogged. All right, so let's talk about getting mogged, okay? So I know that most of you know what it means to be mogged, all right? Even if you don't have the definition handy. I suppose the best way to explain it would be when you are suddenly made aware that you are in the presence of somebody who is kind of dwarfing you, you know, they're outclassing you. Basically, it's when you're in the presence of somebody that's better looking than you, and you're being made to feel very insecure about it. Now, for the purpose of this video, I would say that in order for it to really be mogging somebody, the person who's being mogged has to actually notice it. Like, for example, you wouldn't say that Robert Pattinson is hype-mogging Taylor Lautner, you know, in Twilight, because at the end of the day, you know, he's Taylor Lautner, you know, he's Jacob, like, you know, he's a teen idol. He doesn't have to worry about the fact that Robert Pattinson is a couple of inches taller than him because he's Taylor Lautner. So In order for it to be mogging somebody, the person who's being mogged actually has to be insecure about it for it to really be a mogging. So the question is, or what I'm talking about in today's video, is if you're in that situation where you're being mogged, you know, someone is height mogging you, physique mogging you, you know, relationship status mogging you, you know, whatever the case may be, what do you do? Well, going back to the metaphor at the beginning of the video, a lot of people think counterattack, right? I'm feeling insecure because, you know, there's some guy at the gym who's, you know, looks 10 times better than me and is working out with his hot girlfriend. I'm going to like go and try and bench more weight than him. You know, like a lot of people, their first instinct is to fight back. And that is not the best thing to do. In fact, let me tell you a quick story that happened to me back in 2009. Now, I don't know what it was about that year, but I had more luck with girls in 2009 than I would have before or after. Like, 2008 was good because I had this, I've talked about it in previous videos, this girlfriend. Anyway, so I was constantly, because this is before dating apps, so I was still doing the whole like in-person thing, right? And I actually don't really remember how I met her. All I know is that it was through uni that I met her, but there was this girl that I kind of wanted to get with, and we had a little bit of a chemistry. It's kind of hard to pinpoint, but we had this little bit of a hint that something might happen. Now, I don't really remember the timeline or whose idea it even was, but I think it was my idea. But what happened is that we decided that we were going to go clubbing because, you know, I was 23 and it was the 2000s and whatever, right? So we decided that we're going to go clubbing, and she was going to bring some of her friends that I kind of vaguely knew who they were. Anyway, so we met outside this nightclub, right? The nightclub that we were supposed to meet at. I met her outside. Her friends were in the club already, and she literally took my hand and we walked into the club together. So, you know, at that point, I'm thinking to myself, like, I'm in, right? Like, it's my ball to drop at this point, right? Like, I would have to do something really bad to mess this up. Anyway, so it was kind of early in the evening time. It would have been about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. People are just slowly starting to come into the club. And the girl, she was buying herself a drink. I think she was with one of her girlfriends. And me and her guy friend, who was a pretty chill guy, like no competition at all, him and I were sort of sitting at the bar just chatting about whatever. And all of a sudden, another guy walked in. Okay, a guy walked into the club, and I don't know how to describe this guy, okay? You have to use your imagination, but he was about 6'5", and in terms of, like, face aesthetics, it was about as close to a perfect 10 as you're ever going to get, right? And the guy that I was sitting with, you know, this girl's mutual friend, he recognized him because he had been on some, like, New Zealand reality TV, like, the New Zealand equivalent of The Bachelor. Like, it wasn't The Bachelor. I think it was a few years before that came out. But it was some reality TV show in New Zealand where a bunch of girls compete, you know, to get the guy's attention or something. And he was one of the hot guys on it. So he was kind of like a little bit of a celebrity, at least a local celebrity. And I don't know how to describe it. He just walked in. And he did like that thing where he just kind of surveyed the room, like you just knew because he was by himself. He wasn't there with any entourage, and it didn't matter. Like, it just didn't matter at all. Like, he wasn't self-conscious about being alone. There was just nothing. He just walked into the room, surveyed the scene, saw the girl that I was trying to get with that night, saw that she wasn't with anybody, and just made a beeline straight for her. And that was it. She turned around and accepted his offer for a drink, and that was basically the end of the night for me. So, what should I have done in that situation? You know, I had several options at my disposal. The first option, which was a really good option, which was just leave, you know, recognize, you know, take the black pill, know that it's over for that night. You know, it's if anything's going to happen between me and that girl, it certainly ain't going to be tonight. You know, like just make an excuse and just head on off or just leave without saying anything. Or another option I could have done, because There were several other adjacent clubs, and the guy that I was talking to, her friend, he wanted to go to like a different nearby club. I could have just gone with him, maybe, you know, picked up some other girl. Who knows? You know, I could have done that as well. But you know what I decided to do? I decided, because I was young and I didn't know better, that I would just compete, you know? Like I said to him, because I didn't truly understand the looks pill back then. Like I understood it, you know, to an extent. We all kind of know it instinctively. But yeah, I don't know, maybe because I was actually doing pretty all right back in 2009, maybe I thought I was, you know, more able to compete with this like 6'6" giga chad than I actually was. You know, maybe, I don't know. But when they were like sitting and chatting and staring dreamily into each other's eyes, I went up to them and I started to like kind of butt in, you know. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I went up to them like 30 times and tried to recover the situation, but by that stage it was a done deal, you know, and he knew what was going on, he figured it out. And it's not like she was breaking the rules or he was breaking any rules, because we weren't officially together, like officially we were just there as friends, technically, or I was just an acquaintance, like, you know, I couldn't really like get mad, I just got mogged, you know, that's just what happened. So, yeah, to summarize what happened that night, I was invaded. I was invaded by the Wehrmacht, okay? I was doing well. I had my own, you know, little game going on. And it got rudely interrupted by this Giga Chad. So what did I do? My instinct was to counterattack, to immediately fight back on his territory, on the Chad's territory, and compete in a clubbing situation where I had no chance. And I lost, you know? My army got surrounded, and we lost 400,000, you know, I lost 400,000 prisoners that night. By the way, if you're wondering where I come up with these ridiculous metaphors, I don't know, I just kind of think of them, you know. This meme right here is actually pretty Kino, but anyway, you want to know what the kicker to the whole thing is, right? Do you want to know what the kicker to this whole story is? So the girl that I just told you about in this story, we literally ended up hooking up the following weekend, because all I did was just text her during the week. And I was like, hey, you know, I missed you on Saturday night. What happened? And she told me that they left together, but they didn't go home. Now, that's probably not true, but it wouldn't have mattered anyway, because my goal wasn't to date her. It was just to get with her at least one time, because all I remember about her is that she had like a really nice body. I didn't care if she had been ran through or not. It was just, you know, my goal was to run through her. So it didn't matter, even if they did hook up, which she claims they didn't anyway. So the point is, all I had to do was retreat. And yeah, in doing so, live to fight another day. But anyway, that's not what I did. That night I counterattacked and it blew up in my face. So hopefully you understand the metaphor here. Hopefully you understand the point that I'm getting at. Like, now that I'm a bit older, if I don't want to be somewhere, I just walk out immediately. Like, if I don't want to be somewhere, I just leave. And in doing so, I find my strength. But anyway, I think I've driven that point home now. I think you all get the idea. Now, the other point that I wanted to make is that there are some guys out there that are constantly being mogged. Like, they're suffering from cumulative mogging, right? Like, they feel that every guy they walk past is mogging them, and they feel that every girl out there that they're attracted to doesn't find them attractive. Like, they have this kind of sense that they're second-class citizens in the hierarchy, or third-class citizens, and it builds a kind of lingering resentment which can cause them to want to fight back, to want to counterattack. And again, all it does is lead to their own ending. All it does is lead to their own pain in fighting back. Counterattacking feels like the best thing to do, but it ends up destroying them. Like, I know that ER is like a very extreme example, but it's a good illustration, you know? He started off by throwing hot coffee on couples and everything, like... But, you know, the more he fought back against what he perceived to be his enemies, the angrier he got. You know, fighting back didn't relieve the anger. You know, it's like OCD. If you're obsessive compulsive, and I've suffered from OCD, so I know about this quite a bit, you know, if you have obsessive compulsive disorder and you're washing your hands 50 times a day, the more you do this, the more you wash your hands, the stronger the OCD gets, okay? The first step to treating OCD is stopping the compulsions, okay? Stopping the hand washing, right? And the same is true with ER. If he had moved away from Isla Vista or whatever that college town was and just, you know, moved away completely where he wasn't surrounded by pretty blonde girls, and if he had just retreated, he might have eventually found his strength. But by, you know, going up against the Chads, he just met his own ending. Now, like I said, I think ER is an extreme example, but a much more common thing that you see that I think a lot more, there's a lot of guys out there doing this, is they'll subscribe to these channels like the Whatever Podcast, you know, Fresh and Fit. Now, I don't want to paint too broadly here with a broad brush. Like, I don't want to say that everyone who subscribes to these channels fits this mold, but I think that the audiences of these channels, I feel that the guys that watch this, almost all of them fall into the bottom 50% of the dating hierarchy. I mean, amongst men, right? Like, they are in the bottom 50% of the male population. And the reason why a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them, will watch shows like this, they'll say, oh, it's just because it's entertaining, which I'm sure is true. But the question then becomes, why is it entertaining? And my opinion for many years now has always been that shows like this provide a power fantasy. You see, for all of the coping that you often see amongst, you know, the kinds of guys that refer to themselves as high-value men, the truth of the matter is, most of the people who subscribe to shows like the Whatever Podcast, Fresh and Fit, whether they admit to it or not, they feel that women have all of the privilege, okay? They have all of the breaks on the dating market, right? Which, of course, is the truth. So what they do is they watch these shows where, you know, the host will lure a bunch of unsuspecting women onto these shows where they get blindsided, not because the host is right, but because the host has presence and, you know, organized talking points. And these girls, they're not exactly the best and brightest. So metaphorically speaking, they end up getting slapped around and made to look stupid. And it provides a power fantasy, a kind of intellectual power fantasy for the guys watching that by proxy of the host, they're in charge. You know, they're getting like their psychological victory over the privileged class. But does it make them feel better? No. It just makes them more addicted to that content. Like, don't get me wrong, if you watch this show or Fresh and Fit, I'm not having a go at you personally, it's not like that. I'm just saying that, you know, I've definitely seen this phenomenon where you have these guys that become addicted to this type of content because it's their way of fighting back against getting mogged. Like, I don't mean mogged in the micro, I mean mogged in the macro. And it just leads them down a rabbit hole, you know. They start off watching the Whatever Podcast and Fresh and Fit, and then it leads to Taylor the Fiend, and it just goes further and further. But hey, man, I'm just a lowly scribe in God's army. If you want to, you know, if the next time you get mogged, you want to go up and just push Chad over, that's fine by me. You do what you want to do. The moral of the story for me is that if you want to find your confidence, if you want to deal with, like, I don't know, feelings of insecurity. I know most of you have probably grown out of that. I certainly have. But the best thing to do is just take a step back. And in doing so, you find your strength.